Good morning, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. Here we are again. Oh, I got a good morning. It's like being in the classroom. Doesn't happen in Australian classrooms anymore, I don't think, which is rather a shame. In covering these highly significant chapters of Daniel, chapters 7 and 8, we obviously cannot deal with all that might be interesting. I just wanted to note a few things that were skipped yesterday as we were covering much history and many interesting things, no doubt. But in chapter 7 and verse 5, I wanted to make it clear again that there were two sides there, and to note that that's the same as what we find in chapter 8, where the Persian power, Medo-Persian power, is there described in terms of a ram, chapter 8 and verse 3. So whereas we have two sides implied in chapter 7 verse 5, in chapter 8 verse 3 we have two horns. Now those little points of linkage are very important. You know what I was saying to you the other day, that we've got to be reasonable, don't we? I can't bear with something that's unreasonable. And therefore it's important that we look carefully at the terms of the prophecy and that we see those little linkage points, because that's clearly what Daniel would have done. You know, we can just feel ourselves running along in the same mind as Daniel, can't we? He's got one prophecy there and later on he gets another one 2 years later. He's going to put those two together, he's going to examine them very carefully, isn't he? And he finds little linkage points like that, he's going to say, oh yes, I can see the thought. There's two sides to this kingdom. And of course, as we sell history and deed book, bear that out. Now, I made a summary of those things, which I think might be a little more helpful than what we had yesterday. The kings of Persia that followed Cyrus are called in history the Achaemenids. I always find that word, it's a good name. They were very lofty kings, but not that long. Just struggling a bit because we've got a fairly light room. Alright, is that better? Alright, get it in various stages. I'll summarise there what we might term the history of the Achaemenid kings. And although in fact Cyrus the Great didn't come down until about here, when people speak of the kings of the Achaemenids, they really are speaking of those that came from Cyrus and after. But it's a testimony of how great he was that really that term goes back for three generations to his great-grandfather. But his great-grandfather is almost forgotten in history. But it was his great-grandfather who was actually called Achaemenes. So this is a testimony to him, isn't it? Of what a remarkable man he became. He eclipsed all that was before him. And there's a little bit of the story about Achaemenes. And remember, they were just in that little province, little area, that we called Anshan later on. A bit more than Anshan, because Anshan was kind of a half of it, as that chart makes clear. That's 44 for some reason. Anybody understand these machines better than me? I suppose that the group got this on the table today. It was listed out on the floor. How are you?
The top is still up. The bottom is still up. Thank you.
Alright. We'll take it in stages. Can you read that? Is that better? Alright. So Achaemenes then had a son, his name was Pisthes, I presume we say. And there were two sons then.
And Tiberius decided that he would divide the kingdom at that point. Yeah, all these little things are important, because Cyrus wouldn't have come into a kingdom in his own right, would he? Unless that was divided at that point. He'd be sort of sharing power, and as a younger son he might have got it anyway. But it just so happened that Tiberius divided it at that stage between Cyrus the First. It's not Cyrus the Great. It's Cyrus the Great's grandfather. So the kingdom is divided at that stage, and that's still in that bottom half of the Iranian plateau. The top half was occupied by the Medes. The Medes and Persians were both of an alien stock that came from the east. That's why they were always related, see? They were related in blood from this common origin. And it's by means of this very interesting piece of history that they kept them related. Alright? The kingdom's divided. And this Cyrus the One has a son called Cambyses, who is our Cyrus's father. Alright, so we bring it down a little bit further. There we go. So, then we come down to Cambyses, who's the father of the one we're interested in. Who does Cambyses happen to marry? Well, he marries Mandane. Because Astyages, who is the king of the Medes, above them in the north, his father was that great man Darius, not mentioned biblically, but a great king in the Median history. He has a son called Astyages, who had that fit in his dream where he sees that Mandane, his daughter, doesn't love him. So, like some madly jealous father, he decides he'll marry her off to some inferior person. So he marries her off to a king of the other people who are south, to a king called Cambyses, whose son, by that marriage, was Cyrus the Great. So Cyrus was, you see, of both bloodlines. So that later on, when the soldiers of Astyages felt ill-disposed towards their king Astyages, it was not so unnatural, was it, to take Cyrus the Great as their king, because he was related to them. He was partly of their own stock. And no doubt they thought that Astyages was a bit like his name. He was a bit of a strange fellow. So there we have, in summary, the Medes and the Persians were originally of alien blood from the east, coming out of the east onto the Iranian plateau. And by this intermarriage, they were brought together again in a strong union. Now, in the terms of Daniel's prophecy, how delicately that is expressed. Daniel chapter 7 verse 5 is one beast, but it has two sides. See how you need to be careful about the prophecy? And in Daniel 8 verse 3, it's two horns. One ram, two horns. So that the linkage of those two little details is just one of those divinely given points that make the interpretation so much more reasonable. Now, another point that I did not touch upon yesterday in chapter 7 verse 5 was the three ribs that are spoken of as being in the mouth of it. Now, if you come back to Daniel chapter 6, we read there in the organization of that Medo-Persian Empire, that Darius, chapter 6, verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. So obviously, if there were three presidents put over the 120, the sense seems to be that there were a division of responsibilities. This triple division seems to be associated with that kingdom all the time. And so Brother Thomas suggested that the three ribs in the mouth of the bear were the three presidents. I would rather be inclined to say that perhaps the three presidents being over three separate areas, this bear
who was hungry, as bears always are, that the three ribs may in fact refer not so much to the presidents, but rather to the dominions over which they reign. Now, the speeches about that that lead us to that. Firstly, it's a bear. What do you know about bears? They're ferocious, but really only when they're hungry. And are they hungry? They're proverbially hungry, aren't they? They are the hungry beast. You know, they'll go through a car and get into its windows and get through its back seat into the boot because you've got some food in your boot. That's what's happened in places like America, you know, in their camping grounds and so on. The bear is intensely hungry and he will do anything to get to food. And that's interesting that it's mentioned here as being a bear, and the quality of the bear is mentioned at the end of verse 5. Arise, devour much flesh. So that's an interesting little note. It's a hungry bear, as bears always are. Now if you turn with me to chapter 8 and verse 4, where we have the actions of this bear, of this ram in this case, it says, I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beasts might stand before him. That is, great expansion is implied in that term. Much greater than Babylon ever had. Oh, so much greater. The kingdom of men was expanded by a number of times in the days of the Medo-Persian. So again, watch the details carefully, and the prophecy will just fall out into your lap, so to speak. So we have a bear of great expansion because he's very hungry, and therefore what's in his mouth is expressive of what he's hungry about. What was he hungry about? Hungry about expansion. So I think that's very reasonable to say that the three ribs speak of the territories which he gathered together at that time. And in fact, and here's another very delicate little balance, have a look at Daniel chapter 8 verse 4 again. In which directions did he expand? Northward and southward and westward. I messed up the order. Westward, northward, and southward. And that's exactly what he did do. And is that not three? And would it not be reasonable to say, therefore, that the devouring bear gobbled up those three basic directions of his expansion? And I suggest that in some sort of form, he placed those three presidents over those three general areas. One thing's for certain, the empire had three presidents, it expanded in three directions, and I think those two points lead us to the three ribs, combining what Dr. Thomas said and perhaps a little bit of our own investigation. You might notice, if you can remember it in your mind's eye, that that's exactly the way that Cyrus the Great did expand. Remember how his first move was, having taken over Media, which is northward, he then expanded out towards the west to that great battle against King Croesus of the Lydians, and then he came back, having cleaned all that area up, and he then moved down south against Babylonia. And after he had cleaned that up, he again went up north, very high, up around the Caspian Sea, to a river whose name I can't remember at this point, but it's quite high up in the south of Russia today. So he did move distinctly in those three directions. So the terms of the prophecy, if we just take time and look at them carefully, they almost fall out into our laps. You know, there's a very wonderful passage in Exposition of Daniel. Just make a little note of this. On page 12 of Exposition of Daniel by Brother Thomas, in which he says that, commenting upon the fact that Russia has taken the symbol of the bear today, and that all of this territory is, of course, within the future domain of the final Gogian Confederacy. And then he has a most wonderful extract in which he says that the basic territory that he conquered will come into the domain of Russia, included in which he has Afghanistan and Persia of today. You know, that's very, very thrilling to us, isn't it? You wouldn't have dreamt of saying Afghanistan will fall to Russia some years ago. Do you know, 100 years ago, though, Russia and England were vying for Afghanistan? If you look back in the Christadelphians of the late 1870s and 1880s, you'll find some extremely interesting things there. The Russian was pushing from the north, and England, through people like Palmerston and Salisbury, were pushing from the south. And that old contest has been going on ever since. Finally, the bear has got what she wanted. She's come down and she's occupied that territory. And now we, who've lived since Halmini's time, know just how much that country must be tottering on the brink. How old is Halmini? Well onto his 80s. Foolish old man, somehow or other, still has the grips over a very emotional people. They are just ripe for capture. It's also interesting to note that when they couldn't develop an intelligence service, they had to bring the KGB in to develop for them an intelligence service. I would say they certainly were lacking in intelligence. Iran, Persia, the original area of the bear, the home territory, so to speak. Is that all clear? So that makes that little comment on page 11 in the Exposition of Daniel a very, very interesting comment indeed. Now, yesterday we dealt principally, in terms of history, with the Persian history. It's impossible to deal every day with the history of all of them, of course, and what's more, you wouldn't remember any of it if we did. Today, we're going to deal mostly with the history of the Roman period, both today and tonight, in part. I'm hopeful that tonight we will be able to have also a look at some very interesting slides to show the drama of the times in which we're living in, as we see this most remarkable Roman Catholic pontiff going around the world. But also, we may cover a little more history dealing with the Roman power. That will leave the Greeks, which really are in between. But because in chapter 8, there's a lot said about the goat and the powers that develop from the goat, because chapter 8 really amplifies the Grecian element more than, of course, the one verse in chapter 6, in chapter 7 and verse 6, about the leopard, we're going to deal with the Grecian history at that time. So yesterday, Persian history, today, Roman history, and tomorrow we go back in chapter 8 to pick up the Grecian history. However, just so that you feel that some degree of completeness, we'll just sketch in chapter 7 verse 6 at this stage. I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it the four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. A leopard, of course, what's its quality? Not so much that it's hungry, but that it moves with tremendous speed. And so it was with Alexander the Great. He never had time to chew over the bones, so to speak, of those areas that he had conquered. He was too busy going on to the next. You know, it's said of Alexander that he was probably the greatest general who ever lived. And when you just look at the bare facts of his life, you cannot help but be astounded. Do you know he received the reins of government at the age of 20? Hands up a 20-year-old boy in the room. Is the one? Got a 20, there we are, Gary. World leader, number one. When you just think of it in real terms like that, though, isn't it an astonishing thing that boy had the capacity? And it wasn't that he just happened to do it because his father was perhaps died or something. He was the boy for the job. At 20, he was ready to become the world conqueror. An incredible young man. And he died before his 33rd birthday. And at that time he had really conquered. Sorry, somebody else said it. He died before he had really had opportunity of tasting the spoils of victory. It was just an incredible rampage over the kingdoms that were, particularly over the Persians. What an amazing person he was. So in 12 swift years, it was all over. Again, in chapter 8 and verse 5, you will notice that the prophecy so sensitively mentions that particular feature. He touched not the ground, it says of the goat, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. So we have therefore a very delicate, wonderful record that sketches in with such sensitivity what happened in history involving armies and places and times. You know, we are very privileged to have the word of prophecy. It certainly is an expression of the loving kindness of our Heavenly Father. So Alexander was the beginning of the leopard. Not the beginning of the leopard, really, of course, because just like we've looked at the other kings, there was an interesting background that gave event to them. And so it was with Alexander. Alexander had a father who trained him in those ways. He was a very great king in his own right, Philip of Macedon. It was up in the higher part of Greece. And you know, Philip trained his son from an early age to hate Persians. he bred them. He bred that boy with an absolute hate of Persians. And consequently, when he came to have occupancy of the power, that's what he drove himself against. He drove himself at the ram, as chapter 8 says. He was just mad about the ram, and that's what he was obsessed with. His whole life was like that. He tore that ram of Persia to shreds. Such was the terrific speed, the leopard-like quality of Alexander the Great. Then it says he had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. Well, we noticed, didn't we, that the four wings were like the expansions, as we had in chapter 4. That Assyria that could never rest, it was always on the road with some new marauding exploit. And so the four wings here have to do with expansion of the Greek power. And that's what indeed did happen. Alexander expanded it in all directions. Then it notes in verse 6 that the beast had four heads. Now just like we said before, there were three presidents and three expansions. So also here in verse 6 we have a power that has four wings. He spread himself in all directions. This power came from further west than did the Medo-Persians. The Medo-Persians, they did not spread themselves east, did they? North, west and south. But when you come to the power of the Greeks, you're a long way further over in the west. But this power did extend itself west, east, north and south. In all directions the Greek power went, because this time it could extend itself east, having not had that in the past. And that's what Alexander did. But in fact, before he took off towards the east, he had a very serious series of battles in the west and secured what you might term his base. He went down into the whole of the Greek peninsula, and in fact he crossed into some of Europe. In the leopard of Greece we have the first use of the European continent in the kingdoms of men, in the kingdom of Nimrod. So there were four heads that immediately after Alexander the Great died, these four generals took over from him virtually immediately. That was very different from the line of kings that we had here. It was not so in the Greek Empire. It immediately divided into those four heads. Head standing for an intelligence, a mind that had dominion. Alright, so the leopard had its period of time and gave way in turn, of course, to the Romans. Any questions at that point? Well, chapter 7 and verse 7 introduces us to this fourth beast, of whom this morning we wish to find out the truth. We noticed that it was terrible. Terrible in the original sense of that English word, meaning that it was mighty and causing terror. It was burly. It was dreadful, it also says. A Hebrew word, dekel, D-E-C-H-A-L, meaning to crawl. It's suggestive of something like a crocodile or a dragon. So Brother Thomas refers to it as the Greco-Roman dragon. So very clearly it is taken up in that sense, of course, in Revelation 12 and Revelation 13, where we have the dragon introduced to us in that book. To crawl. It says also, it was dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And the logic of that is that it was stronger than the powers that had gone before it. It was a superior kingdom in terms of its strength. Not in terms of its nobility, but in terms of its strength. You notice again in chapter 2. You might notice in chapter 2, verse 40, that's the quality of that power, that fourth kingdom that is there emphasized. Iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And that is brought through into chapter 7 and verse 7. Very clear echoes, aren't they, one to the other. And therefore highly suggesting to us on just one immediate reading that this is the same power. Now Rome's ascendancy is a very interesting story. I haven't time to deal with it in detail, like perhaps we looked at that interesting history of Medo-Persia yesterday, because we have so much else in the future, in future years, to look at in this same chapter. But basically it goes along this line. It firstly began to reign over the Italian peninsula. This is just a brief summary of the expansion of how this a great beast came to occupy world dominion. It firstly reigned over the Italian peninsula. That's point number one. Then in 168 BC, it took over Macedonia, where the Greeks were, and made that a Roman province. Is that clear?
Distinct in your eye? Have you got a picture of that? In other words, they came west, and they occupied the original area of the Greeks. This is done by my professional cartographer. And now I find that Greece, in fact, is not there.
But we came close. It's Greece. It's just over here. This is the Aegean Sea, and here's Greece. Can you see Greece?
Right.
Up in the north is Macedonia. Down here, we have the area of Athens and Corinth. And it's got that big knob on the end, which we call the Peloponnesus. And it was on that knob that the Spartans developed. Just above them was the area of the Athenian Greeks. And above them were the Macedonians. Alexander came from here. The Macedonian area, his father being Philip, king of Macedonia. And that he therefore first had to subjugate these people. When Italy, when Rome began to take over, it was over here, their conquest of Greece took place in 168 BC. In 133 BC, they spread further east. And they took here a kingdom called the Kingdom of Pergamon. You know the city of Pergamos in the Seven Ecclesias? It's a princely city, a royal city. It has an appearance as of a royal city. An outstanding city and a very fortified place. And was, of all the cities in Asia, it was clearly the one that stood out before its capacity to withstand siege. It was a natural fortress. And very early in the peace, because of the will of the king of Pergamon, it was bequeathed, would you believe it, to the Roman king at that time, Roman leadership. I can't remember who the man's name was at that time. But it was bequeathed in 133 BC to the Romans. And so the Romans got a foothold in the province of Asia. And from that foothold, they developed the province, the Roman province of Asia.
trying to work out what this big lake is. And I'm lost. It shouldn't be there, I think. But never mind.
Oh, I know what's happened. Right. This really is the Aegean Sea here, isn't it? This will be joined to the Mediterranean here.
Right.
So this is the Aegean Peninsula, and this is Turkey here. Something like that.
I'll give some better instructions to my cartographer next time.
It was done in haste, so we could give it. All right. So then they obtained then the kingdom of Pergamon. That gave them a foothold into Asia, and from that they then began to develop their Asian province.
You know, Pergamon always was the capital because of its early and consistent loyalty to the Roman cause. And that's reflected actually in the letter that Christ sent to the city of Pergamos. He speaks there of dwelling where Satan's seat is. Alright, in 65 BC, they took over Syria. And by doing that, they broke the Seleucid kingdom.
Now, the Seleucid kingdom was one of the four that came from the Middle power. And it was the kingdom that controlled the northern part of, well, Palestine. In the southern part, we had the kingdom of the Ptolemies. That was another one of the four. When therefore they came over and they took over Syria, and in a series of campaigns that were conducted by Pompey. When they came over here and they conducted a series of campaigns in Syria and took over the Seleucid Empire, they then had access, of course, to the Holy Land.
That was the work, essentially, of that great general Pompey. And, of course, that brought them then into contact with the people of God. And so the Roman power came into Egypt, then coming down the coast in 63 BC. I think the occupancy of Palestine was 66. Does anybody remember that? I think that's right. Pompey occupied Palestine in 66 BC. And so we have, therefore, virtually
from Italy, right over here, right through this territory down into Egypt, we have indeed an empire of the world.
Now, the quality expressed that it was strong exceedingly and had great iron teeth is in fact verified by scripture, by history. If you were to look up the history books of the conquests of the Romans, you will see just how barbaric they were. When they went to war, they really did it in a very vigorous and determined way. It says they devoured. You know, there's emphasis upon that quality. They devoured and break in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. That was the iron will of the Roman people. When you think of Italy today, you don't think of a country like that at all. It just shows you how different a nation can be in a later period of time. But that's how they were originally. A very forceful, strong, cruel people. The cruelty of the Roman legions was proverbial in the world at that time. It was much more so than that which was between the Greeks, at the time of the Greeks. But because of that, you see, they held their empire together for a very long period of time. Whereas the Greek empire, after Alexander, immediately divided into four, that was not so in the time of the Roman ascendancy. And you might notice that as a contrast, see? Verse 6, there was an immediate division, but not so with the Romans. It was strong exceedingly. And there were different ways in which that strength was noted. Not only because of its ferocity upon the field of battle, but also because of its solidarity. Italy was solidly behind Rome. You contrast that, for example, in the period of Alexander. Alexander always had to do.
We now come to realize this, the Greek Peninsula,
Well, Alexander was situated up here, but he's always having to put up with pin-pricking and problems that came to him from Athens and Thebes
and those lower southern areas of Greece. They were always trying to cause some sort of rebellion against what they considered was their rather crude leader above them. But not so in the time of the Romans. They brought everything together with them and continually stamped their impress wherever they were. So that when the census of the Roman army was taken in those earlier times, it was found to be an army of 770,000 fighting men. That's a standing army. That's an incredible number of soldiers to have ready to hand at any one time. In fact, in the uniform of soldiers, you compare that with Alexander's. Do you know what the largest number of men that Alexander ever had? 35,000 men. He was a phenomenon. It was because of his tremendous leadership that he just tore into armies that sometimes were many times his size. But you see, with 35,000 men, you can't stamp your imprint upon the world for a long period of time. Another factor in it was the very prosperous nature of the large river valleys in Italy. There were much greater numbers of population to call upon than Alexander had in the very sparse and rugged, stony territory of the Greek peninsula. All of those factors combined to make this power greater than what had come before. Perhaps nothing illustrates it more than the length of the kingdom. So if you've got a little piece of paper, just make a quick jot on these details. Some of them you already know. How long did the kingdom of Babylon last for at its centre? 70 years. From 606 to 536. Alright? 606 to 536. The Medo-Persians lasted for 206 years. From 536 to 300. Should be 330. Around about that period of time. Then the Greeks, that kingdom lasted for 235, but not as a united kingdom by any stretch of the imagination. It really depends as to what year you take for Rome taking over. If you take from the year that she took over Macedonia, then the Greeks only lasted 132 years. Much inferior to the Romans. For the Roman power, and if now we take the later date of 65 BC, the Roman power went through for over 500 years and was eclipsed in 476 as a united Roman power when Odoacer of the Ostrogoths took over from the very weak emperor at that time. His name was Romulus or Gustulus. So a period of 450-500 years of total occupancy of the world was an outstanding achievement. And so the terms of verse 7 become very real to us. So the time indicated strength and bore out the very details that Daniel had given to us. It also mentions, though, that it had nails of brass. It says that verse 19, there's a little detail there, not given in the description in verse 7, that was exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And so there were in it of the qualities of the Greek power. When you look at the history of Rome, you'll see that that's exactly true. In fact, there's a little proverbial statement which says that Rome defeated upon the battlefield, but Greeks conquered in terms of culture and language and learning, organisation. So that really the Romans gathered together all that was good in the Greek world and incorporated into their domain. Now the other feature that we notice about this power is that it was diverse from the others. And the immediate statement after that indicates the way in which it was so diverse. It says it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Like in chapter 2 again, there were 10 toes. Mentioned as 10 toes. So as the leopard had 4 heads, and they stood for 4 divisions, so we would understand that the 10 horns are an extra phase now of that which was a united power before. And of course, that is exactly in accord with history. The history of the change from that united power to the period of the 10 horns goes something like this. It is, of course, the subject of Revelation chapter 8, where we have the first of the 4 trumpets. And the history goes through the period from 395 to 476, in which there's this transference from a single-headed creature or single power to a division into 10 powers, but they're all going to be yet combined. But there's going to be entities within this kingdom as there had not been before. So the first 4 trumpets in Revelation chapter 8, if you'd like just to quickly look at them. The only way really to study Daniel, of course, is in a long-term verse-by-verse class, really, because there's just so much integration of detail, both scriptural and historical. But very quickly, Revelation chapter 8, verse 7, mentions the first angel. I won't talk about the details of it, but it's a trumpet that he blows. And the effects of that were seen in Alaric and his Visigoths. And terrible plight was brought upon the section of the Roman world at that time. Verse 2 speaks about the second angel sounding up, as it were a great mountain, burning with fire, cast into the sea. This was Genseric and his Vandals, whose conquests were upon the sea, both against Europe and against northern Africa. Then in verse 10 we have the third angel, a lamp, it fell upon the third part of the rivers. This is the work of Attila and his Huns, who did go into that area where all the rivers of Europe begin. And great conquests were achieved by the Vandals, by Attila, and his Huns. Attila and the Huns. And then fourthly, in verse 12, we have the fourth angel sounding, when Odoacer and his Ostrogoths, from 476 to 533, they took over Rome. And they took the authority away from the last emperor, whose name was Romulus Augustulus. Why do you think that's interesting? Because that's where it started, isn't it? Remember, Romulus and the first emperor's name was Augustus, wasn't it? And the last emperor's name is Augustus. So the very founder of Rome was Romulus, and his name incorporated, this last emperor's name incorporated both. That surely is not an accident in history. Now, how do we summarise all the other details in this chapter? I want you to take that piece of paper again. If you haven't got one, ask someone next to you. Obviously, we're not going to deal with all of those this morning. We couldn't. But I want this to be a very reasoned approach. And I think that in being reasonable, we have the strongest argument that will appeal to all people, all our brethren and sisters, and outside people as well. It will appeal to them as undoubtedly what the explanation is. This little horn of the goat, of the fourth beast in verse 8 is what we're particularly interested about. Let us first read about in verse 8, I consider the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. Read every verse, every word carefully. Among them another little horn. So, if a horn stands for a power, a little horn stands for that which is, at least in temporal means, small. He's little in temporal power. but my word, infinite, is profound. Before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Not a bad achievement. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now this is truly why it is so diverse. Not only were the 10 horns that came, but among them there's this particular feature which became the centre of attraction as Daniel was watching the passage of those four beasts. And it's that little horn that intrigued him. Look what he says in verse 15. Or verse 11, the further situation of the vision saw this. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. And then he says, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So the little horn with its voice speaking great words goes right through until the time of the destruction. It's clear that that little horn with its voice is of exceeding importance. And Daniel, perceiving that, said in verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. What was it particularly that he wished to know? I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the thing. It was the little horn that particularly intrigued him. For when he knew that they were four great beasts, which was so similar to what he had learnt, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn, that had eyes and a mouth and that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And it was revealed to him in verse 21 that as he beheld that the same horn made war with the saints, God's holy ones, and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days took that prevailing away. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High God. And so he saw that that kingdom was going to continue through, and it would have a mouth that said great things against God's people until it should be taken out of the way. Now I have summarized here a list of items which have to do with that little horn. The first one is that it's clearly Roman. Why is it Roman? Well, it came up among the others. Alright? That's an important point. It came up among the other horns. It specifically says that in verse 8. So there's no use looking for something that is not Roman. Point number 2, it arose after the other horns. Verse 20 says that again, and verse 24 says that. And another shall arise after them. He shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. So it's going to be after the others, verse 20 and verse 24. It conquered 3 others. We've seen in verse 8 and verse 20. Point 4, it's diverse, different in kind to the others, in that it has eyes, a mouth, and is more stout. There's something bolder about that horn than anything else that would be seen in Earth's history. And I say Earth's history because that's what we've got. Alright? From the gold of Babylon to the saints taking the kingdom. What have we got? The history of mankind. This is going to have a stouter look than anything else in Earth's history. You know, just the simplicity of this argument is very appealing. Point 5, It is blasphemous. Time and again, its mouth is mentioned. Verse 8, it has mouth speaking great things. When God says that, it's clearly implying that it's speaking as though it were God, isn't it? What about verse 11? At the great words which the horn spake, is it right for lowly man to be speaking great words? So when God puts it like that, we can assume that it is speaking blasphemously. But that's made very clear in verse 25. He shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws. So, more stout means that he is blasphemous, speaking against the Most High. He is lawless, verse 21. He changes times and laws to suit himself, as verse 25 also tells us. He is a persecutor of the saints. Verse 21, I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. That quality is mentioned again in that verse 25 that we just read. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High, which means, brothers and sisters, that the saints had to be there to be worn out. I believe there was always a witness, and I believe that verse is an indication of that. Hence the very valuable word of our brother Alan Eyre in writing up for us in these latter times such books as the Protesters and the other one, Brethren in Christ. Point number 8, his duration is given. He would go right through until he should be consumed at the judgment of Christ. Point number 10, his judgment is... Point number 9, his judgment, verse 26, there shall be in stages. The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. It's an interesting little detail, because we often have that picture of more than one battle involved in the coming of Christ. I think there's a very real logic to that, and scripture seems there to be underlining that, doesn't it? Unto the end. When Christ comes, he will eradicate that system till there's not a skerrick of it left in the earth. Point number 10, the judgment is to be complete unto the end. So it'll be gradual and complete. What did I mention as number 8? The duration of his period is right. Point number 11, he will prevail, however, until Christ's return, because in verse 27 it says, and the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom and the whole heaven shall be given to the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting dominion, and all nations shall serve and obey him. Or point number 11, I beheld even then, because of the voice of the great words, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now, I'm not really going to say very much more this morning, for two reasons. I don't think I need to, and I haven't got time to. But if you look at that list of items that you've got before you, my dear brothers and sisters, there's only one answer to that, isn't there? In every one of those points, Rome suffices. The papacy suffices absolutely every one of those points. Let us quickly fill in a few of the details. Was it Roman? Of course it was Roman. It was the very pith of Rome. One of the historians so brilliantly says that when the papacy arose, it was like the ghost of the old Roman Empire coming forth in religious garbs. It preserved all things that were Roman and added to them. There it was, sitting right on the very centre of the Roman Empire, on the city of Seven Hills. Did it arise after the others? Yes, it did. It arose after 476, after the Roman Empire in its unity had been broken up into 10 parts. How, in fact, did it arise? It arose because at that time the Roman world was divided into two emperors, two seats of authority, one at Constantinople in the east and the other in Rome in the west. And then by two famous decrees, that of Justinian in his decretals, which went from 529 to 533, he gave increasing power to the Bishop of Rome. All that the Bishop of Rome wanted, he eventually received, until he became universal bishop and was able to exercise a tremendous temporal power as well. That was confirmed and even increased in 606 by the decree of Phocas. A more bitter, savage, brutal man never occupied the throne. Nevertheless, he in Constantinople gave to the bishop in Rome very great powers above all other people in the world. And so he arose after the other horns had been developed. By that time the Roman Empire had broken up after 476 into its several parts. Concerning the ten horns, various historians will differ perhaps a little bit from time to time with some of those, but there essentially is a list. The Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Kingdom of Ravenna, some that will interchange that with the Luli, the Lombards, the Franks, the Suavi, the Alans and the Bavarians. In Eureka you can find an interesting description of each one of those, which shows how it became an entity in itself. Ten separate peoples, which had formed after those four trumpets had blown as the judgments of God split that empire up. Although there had been 500 years of remarkable peace, it was no longer going to be that way. Our third point, it conquered three others. That's indeed just what the power of the papacy did. Charlemagne, for example, removed three of the horns. Those horns were not always exactly just ten, and at times they varied in the prominence of one over the other. Just like in Europe today, you can't count exactly ten, but there's essentially been around about ten all through that period of time. The Heruli, the Ostrogoths and the Vandals were by Charlemagne on behalf of the Pope completely eradicated as he worked wonders on behalf of the papacy. It says that it had eyes to see. Well, there's never been an intelligence service like the papacy. Wherever it operates, there is a continual gathering of information that goes back to the Pope in Rome. It's been a very perceptive and alert worldwide intelligence source, and it has its angels, its messengers that go forth to do its work. The people like the Jesuits, that having heard of things, they go about to effect their will in the world. In fact, it calls itself the Holy See, the Holy See, which says really, in other words, that it's in competition with the angels of God, which Daniel described as the watchers, and which in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9 are spoken about as the eyes of God that go forth to show themselves strong on behalf of him whose heart is perfect towards them. Well, this is particularly spoken of as having eyes, and so it describes itself, mind you, as the Holy See. Our point number six, that was that it was lawless. And of course, if you look up the history of Rome, she did what she liked with law. She changed the times and laws. She changed the Sabbath onto the Sunday. She did all kinds of things at her own will and fancy. Has she been the persecutor of saints? Well, my dear brothers and sisters, if there was no other detail given, that would be sufficient. The historical persecutor of people like us has been the papal system. Not for 10 years or 100, but for hundreds of years. For over 1,000 years, it did as it willed with the liberty of mind of other people, just removing them as she saw fit, or getting the armies of Europe to affect her will. And so in every detail we have found that she answers to the terms of the prophecy. There's no other system that even comes remotely near answering those 11 points. Is she still in existence today? Of course she is. Is she going to prevail until Christ returns? Of course she is. In fact, in this very hour, she is gaining ascendancy in the world. There cannot be, I believe, any possible reason to doubt the basic understanding of that chapter. And that's very important to you and I. Tonight we'll perhaps underline that. But if we do not so exceed that system that God hates, we will not also know as clearly why he loves the truth. And that's what I think is happening in a very real way to our brotherhood today. Hatred of the thing that is wrong is related to love of the thing that is right. If I see that my Heavenly Father thinks that about that system, and what he says about it in Revelation chapter 17 and 12 and 13, then I am galvanized into action in defense of that beautiful truth that God has given me. But if I don't see it like that, then I'm going to let things slip. I'm going to be much more careless in my disposition. That clearly is why that message is given to us. You ask me, why is the brotherhood with weakness today? I say that one of the very basic reasons is because somebody's come along and said, for example, that Revelation 7 has got to do with Israel. I couldn't think of any more disastrous doctrine in its long-term effects than that. Because that's not only going to breed anti-Semitism, mind you, into the people of God, but it's also going to completely blindfold us as to whom the real enemy is. And what about our feelings of fellowship with our brethren and sisters over the years? All our lines, our connections with the truth of God, the people that have fought for it over those years, are broken and devoured. You know, that's a devastating thought, an unbelievable thought that could find itself into literature which bears the name of a Christadelphian. And I say that with every degree of sincerity and concern. And I really want you to think about that issue. It's not an issue of complacency. I cannot see it that way. I would like to feel that way. I am by nature perhaps destined to feel like that. But I cannot see that issue like that. It is not something where we can just allow the two to grow alongside with each other. It is not such an issue. It is an issue which our Heavenly Father feels tremendously involved and which his Son has given to us the most stern, serious warning. If we're on his side, then it is not an issue of complacency. But in all of our dealing with it, might I appeal to this? Do so with it reasonably. In other words, look at the basic facts of the prophecy. Make sure that we have read that carefully, we know what it's talking about, and let the power of the argument itself prevail. And I believe on that ground, it will prevail. The alternative is disaster.